Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is hour number two of the program. I'm David Inge, the host for the show. Harriet Williamson is the producer. Jason Croft is at the controls for this hour. And Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. You know, over time here in Focus, I've been lucky enough to talk with a number of writers, some of them who were visiting the campus, sponsored by the Creative Writing Program in the Department of English. We have a series here that's called the Carr Series. It brings writers to the campus so that students can talk with them about writing, and then also anyone can stop by and meet the author and hear something of their work. And we have, as our guest in the studio this morning, one of these writers. Amelia Gray is her name. She's visiting the campus here. She'll be giving a reading this afternoon at the Illini Union Bookstore. And on the program, we'll talk a little bit about her and about her writing and about her most recent book. It's a novel. It is her first novel. The title of the book is Threats. She currently makes her home in Los Angeles. She grew up in Tucson, also lived for a while in Austin. Her two previous books, both well-received, were A.M. P.M., that was from 2009, and also Museum of the Weird from 2010. And if you would like to hear from her, more from her, stop by the Illini Union Bookstore, the Author's Corner, this afternoon at 4:30. That's on the campus. And here this morning as we talk, questions are welcome, questions, comments. You want to give us a call, 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And the email, if you'd like to send a comment that way, that's will-talk@illinois.edu. Her new novel is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I'm really pleased. As I said, I think it's always been really interesting for me. I've had the opportunity to meet and talk with a lot of writers, people who do poetry, people who write stories, people who write novels, and it's always great to meet the person and be able to ask them some questions about the work. This book is, maybe we can give a very, very brief sketch of what it is about, and then we can talk maybe about the writing. How would you just if I just said, all right, well, tell me what is Threats about? How would you introduce it?
I would say all you need to know about Threats is it's about a man named David and his wife named Franny. David used to work as a dentist. Franny used to work as an esthetician, and Franny dies. And the rest of the book is spent David moving through grief, trying to determine what happened to her. She dies in this mysterious way. And as the police start coming by the house and start inserting themselves into his life, he starts finding these mysterious threats. The threats are hidden behind coffee pots, behind wallpaper, in picture frames, carved into the television. And so he doesn't know who is leaving the threats, who wrote the threats, and how his wife died.
Mm-hmm. And the really what the book is, I think, is in part about it's an exploration of how an individual becomes unhinged as a result of extreme traumatic shock and stress.
Yes.
And of the man's wife, but also maybe there's some suggestion that that's not the first extreme stress in the man's life. So you mm-hmm. have to kind of wonder what was his condition even before the mm-hmm. wife dies.
Perhaps he is a little odd to begin with. Yes,
perhaps a little bit.
Yes,
the threats are and maybe you could give us a couple of examples of the threats. What's interesting about the threats, and we can talk some more about this, is that they're almost like really short stories or poems. There's something that wonderful. They're like just wonderful little gems in and of them.
Yeah, that was the goal. And actually, the book started with the writing of the threats. I wasn't intending to make anything more of them than that. So I did want them to be standalone pieces in their own way.
I think you actually did readings just of the threats.
I did,
Before there was the novel.
Uh-huh.
Well, can you give us cite a couple of examples of the threats?
Sure, I have a few. One is, curl up on my lap. Let me brush your hair with my fingers. I am singing you a lullaby. I am testing for structural weakness in your skull. That's one of them. And another one is, try to kiss me. See what happens to your lips. and so similar kind of odd threats. Or there was one that didn't quite make it into the book that was, "I'm going to make you wish that nobody had ever been born."
Some, you know, they have greater impact when I hear you read them than when I see them on the page. They're less like Zen koans, and they're more like threats. Well, where did that come from? Where does this idea come from?
I'm not sure. The idea came from an unnamed protagonist writing a threat to an unknown recipient, and so they range very much in what's going on. There's one about burrowing a hole in this person's heel and letting the innards drip out, and there's one about cross stitching an image of their burning home over his bed while he sleeps, and where those came from, I'm not totally sure. I wrote them under some kind of mental duress, which is how I write some stories.
This is, I can imagine some people, after having read Threats, having one of two conflicting ideas about you, either that they thought that you were wonderful and fascinating, or would want to make sure that they were never in the same room with
yeah,
you.
Yeah, horrifying.
Horrifying.
Yeah, I've heard that. Yeah. Yeah. I think I'm a nice person in real life.
Well, so far, things to be going okay,
right.
But you haven't threatened me.
Yeah. I've got these pencils I can just jam.
See, there you go.
There
you go. The book, it is dark and edgy for sure, and but there is an odd, twisted sense of humor in the book. Is that you? Is that a reflection of you? Do you
think? That is very much a reflection of me. I've got a Twitter account where I mostly tell stupid jokes all day, and everything in my existence has some humor. I was just at urgent care, actually, not super long ago, with the bronchitis that I've had for a month and a half, and it was just nonstop jokes. Everyone who came through was funny, either funny to me or funny in my mind. Are you curious?
I don't know. I'm just sort of looking at her and not really exactly sure where to go next. Someone that I talked to, a writer that I talked to a long time ago, and I'm not even sure I remember who it was, said something really interesting about why it is that we read. And it's actually the kind of thing that many people have repeated. And it was something along the lines of, well, the reason that I read, and he was talking about fiction. So the reason that I read is I can only meet so many people in my life. And that's this idea that what attracts people to reading fiction is the idea that maybe you can have some sense of how another person experiences the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so get into another person's head, have some feeling for another life that's completely different from yours.
Mm-hmm.
Was there something about particularly this character that made you want that? Or was it even not a deliberate sort of thing about you thinking, well, I wonder what, you know, given this sort of set of circumstances and that would mean and how it would be to live inside that person's skin?
Right. The book came from that curiosity. I had this, I wrote the threats, and then I thought they would just, I was done with them. And then I had a vision of a man standing at the top of the stairs, and I was in the man's space, I guess. Weird. So I was at the top of the stairs and looking down the stairs at a woman, and we're both holding the same stair rail, and she seems very calm, is wearing all these clothes, and her legs and feet are covered in blood. And that was such an interesting image that I had to write that image. And then from there, I wondered, well, what kind of woman would be calm and what kind of man would be calm, or, you know, what would cause that sort of standoff to occur? And then as that I wrote that chapter and the following chapter, and then him kind of in this bubble of of depression or grief, or kind of unable to interact normally with the world, and then consider, well, has he ever interacted normally with the world? What kind of, and then as things get longer, then I always wonder, when as the story gets longer, what do these characters do for a living? What kind of job would make sense for a man like this? And I said, well, and then dentistry obviously came to the forefront.
Obviously.
Yeah.
I have found myself wondering, what's it like to stare into people's mouths?
All day.
All day.
Every day.
Every day. Yes.
Right. The dentistry profession is so interesting to me. There's a lot of education. They're incredibly intelligent. And then the job is to work with these, work in gross mouths, basically, various levels of grossness all day, and stinky, and people don't like you very much, and they could bite you at any time. And it's kind of like a threatening time to put your hands into somebody's mouth. And so what kind of person would like that job? And the dentists I've had in my life have been wonderful. And
yes, we don't write in.
We're
not anti-dentists. We're not running down the dental profession.
Right. And, you know, very warm individuals. But I was thinking, somebody who is really, who is maybe a little off mentally and a dentist, what would he be like? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I had a lot of fun writing that.
Well, and you did. This is something that I have talked about with other writers and people. I'm not sure if they really understand that writers, people who write fiction, end up having to do a lot of research to learn certain things, because mm-hmm. if, for example, you have a character who's a dentist, well, you're going to have to learn some stuff about dentistry.
Sure.
So you can write convincingly about that. So mm-hmm. you did actually spend some time reading up on dentistry.
I did. And I think that all writers who write like that, using reality in that way, do research and also do use things that they already know. So my father is an engineer. And so I think I approached the dentistry profession as kind of with the research, but also thinking of somebody who thought very logically as an engineer would. And I don't know, I didn't really purposefully do that, but it just came into my mind like that. And so I did spend a lot of time researching different words for things, and gingival sulcus, and different words for cavities, and different the history of dentistry. But I mostly just did that for fun. I don't know.
Well, what does that be, having that? I suppose you really wouldn't. You could make the character be a dentist, and you could make more general references to dentistry that would just come out of the everyday experience that anybody would have had to going to the dentist. I mean, what does taking, going that next step, and to the extent that you did, immersing yourself in dentistry, I mean, what do you think? What does that do for the work, or is that mostly engaging your own curiosity?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, it only helps for the verisimilitude of the work, and the reality of the work, and to really sit and think about, because as a marketing writer, which is what I do for a living, I think a lot about people's professions already. I think a lot about actually on the way here, I was talking to John over there about slate roofs, because I wrote about do-it-yourself projects for a long time. And so I think, so myself as a marketing writer, I do approach the world with that lens. And then, so it was fun to think of imagining if I was a dentist, or putting myself in the body of a dentist, and imagining how you would look at people, and when people smiled, you would maybe take a look at their teeth and see how they were doing, and or you'd think about the last time you had worked on, like David in the book works on his father's teeth, and the weirdness of that, and so yeah, the research was really just to give myself kind of a baseline through which I could then try and imagine what the world would look like to him.
Our guest in this point of focus is Amelia Gray. She is here visiting the campus for the Carr Reading Series. So her visit here is sponsored by the Department of English and the Creative Writing Program. She'll be doing a reading this afternoon at 4:30 in the Illini Union Bookstore in the Author's Corner. The book is a novel, and it's her first novel. Her other books include AM, PM, and The Museum of the Weird. And she's here with us. And questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk, willtalk at illinois.edu. You just very, very briefly talked about how this the central character is this man named David, who was a dentist. He loses his practice because he was involved in a malpractice lawsuit, and the event that's really at the center of this is the death of his wife, which mm-hmm. a description of it really begins and ends the book,
yes.
essentially. Although I'm not sure that really leaves you with any better. You go all the way through, and you try to follow him through this dark, sort of tortured trip that he takes, and I'm not sure that at the end you really have any better idea what happened than mm-hmm. you do at the beginning. And even some, I read a lot of reviews of the book, and there were some reviewers that even questioned whether or not his wife was dead.
Mm-hmm.
For sure? Do you think that she's dead?
Well, I will say that I came into writing this book thinking about what an old teacher of mine said, actually in one of my first literature classes back in high school, which was in terms of if you see it and I see it, then it's there. This concept of reading a work. If you think it's about this and you can convince me of this, then it's true. And not that you believe that it's true, it's that it is true. And I found that idea to be so fascinating that I wanted to write a book that would really, truly allow for different interpretations. And I have one about it, and I've been trying to not share it too much. Although I think it's very clear how she dies in the book. I say it in one sentence somewhere in the middle of a paragraph.
I must have missed that.
It's missable. It's missable by design. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But
uh-huh.
I wanted to have the reality of the book as I saw it to be very clear to me, but also to have these other ideas. The idea that she could be alive, I see as a very possible interpretation and idea of it. And people say, well, here's what I think happened to her, and then they tell me, and I say, well, I really like that. That could actually really work.
Yeah.
I think that could.
Well, I think that part of the appeal of the book, at least for some people, I'm sure part of the appeal of the book is that as you go along, you keep asking yourself, what of this is real? Is any of this real?
Mm-hmm.
Or what part of this is real?
Mm-hmm.
And what of this is in the real world? And what of this is taking place in his imagination,
mm-hmm.
or in the way that he's experiencing the world?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I find the experience of reading fiction is always creating your own response to it. And bringing your own thoughts and your own experiences to it, and I kind of wanted to push that with this book.
Yeah.
And
this idea, I think that maybe actually some people have gone too far with this idea that you come to something like a book, and that the writer might say this is what it's about, and then one reader might say, well, I think this is what it's about, and another reader might say, no, I think it's about something else.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's this idea that, well, anybody's interpretation is as good as anybody else's. And I think that then, though, others will come along and say, well, no, that's not exactly right. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you can pitch me what your interpretation is, but you've got to tell me how it is you got to that,
right.
And you've got to have some good foundation to build that on, and then maybe we'll see whether that's
right. Okay. There needs to be some satisfaction in reading the book as well, or else you might as well just sit and think about your own stories in your head.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the balance that I found I needed and wanted to strike, and my editor really wanted me to strike of well, I had a real anti-ending in the first draft, and she didn't much like that. My whole point was that it didn't matter. And she said, well, it matters. It does matter. So like what happens? And so I added that last chapter.
So this, no, this interests me because sometimes I wonder whether there is any editing anymore. At least you see, I see books all the time that I think there was no editor, was there? You have an editor you have that kind of relationship with, that the person can look at it, something you've written, and say, no, you know, really, this is not, you should redo this or go in a different direction.
Yes, very much so. Emily Bell at FSG was incredible in shaping the book. I know I gave it to her when it was only 14,000 words, and so she saw it, the earliest possible draft, and allowed me to develop it without giving me any thoughts. And then once I had a complete draft in my mind, but I felt unsure about parts of it, then we went back and forth. And we went back and forth through about 10 or 12 pretty thorough conversations about the book. I wouldn't say that they were rewrites or total revisions, but it was big elements about characters and about how much you can divulge and how much you can keep to yourself, and she was very good. Ultimately, she knew that and made it clear that it was my choice as the artist, but as a reader, she was really and then a reader turned editor was like incredible in guiding it, which is I think all you can ask for in an editor.
We have a caller in Belgium. It's a town. It's not the country.
Oh, okay.
Okay. And line number four. Hello.
Yes. Good morning. I've always wondered if after hours they don't get out the equipment and work on themselves. Thank you very much.
Okay. Well, see, now that's not the folks, that doesn't represent the way what we think of dentists.
Or writers.
Or writers. Well, I know writers do after hour. They got out the equipment and they work
hours
on themselves.
Yeah, it's very strange.
That's right. Question, other questions, comments, thoughts, reflections, 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455.
I like that, though. I think that there is a shared sentiment of the darkness of dentistry. People don't trust them, you know.
I think that actually would have fit in threats if the dentist was working on himself.
Mm-hmm.
You talked a little bit about how this begins with the threats that you had written these threats, and that in fact you had even done some readings where it was just you standing in front of the microphone and you were reading, just
yes,
reading from the threats,
mm-hmm,
and then you started thinking, well, okay, where do we go with this? This maybe is a reflection of your interest in the story as a form, and particularly, I think I read somewhere you said in one of the interviews that I read that you liked really, really short stories.
Mm-hmm.
For you, it's almost like the shorter, the better.
Yeah.
Why? What is that about?
Well, as kind of a minimalist, I think it's really fun to see how great an impact, an emotional impact can you have in a small amount of time. How does that change when you lengthen it into a novel? And I just finished, I've been back to writing very short stories lately. I finished a 300-word short story yesterday. And then before that, I did a 600-word short story about Ulysses S. Grant. And I really enjoy kind of jumping in like you're almost like time traveling in or portaling in and experiencing as full of a world as you can and then getting out of there. And like I said before, the reader brings their own experience to the work. And so how much a really good piece of flash fiction can really involve the reader in a way that maybe a very long kind of realist piece, the reader kind of sits back and is more of an observer.
Yeah. Oh, so that's 300 words, like on a standard page, 300 words is about a fast three paragraphs.
Sure. Yeah.
It's not.
Yeah.
That's not very much.
No, not at all.
That's not very much. That seems to me like that would require some fairly extreme discipline, at least in the sense that, you know, that no word can be superfluous.
Yes.
Everything has to be. No, it's just got to be that
right
word in that place.
Yes, everything is very precise, which I really enjoy as a perfectionist. And my first book, AMPM, was 120 short pieces, about 150 words to maybe 200 words each. And they each link together in some way. There are, I think, I can't remember anymore, 26 characters, I think, and each of the characters has two links to other characters. So it was a big experiment in how little you can pare back, how much you can pare back, rather, and retain a narrative.
So then what interested you then about the working in the longer form? Because this Threats is a novel, and it's the first novel that you'd written.
Well, the first novel I've published.
I see. Okay. Well, so you have written, you have a drawer with some other novels
in
there?
I do, yeah. Some bad ones. Three bad ones. And those bad ones were kind of an exercise in writing long, just trying to stay very long in a scene or with a character, and ultimately the characters didn't interest me, and the length of the scene I was writing boring. And so the trick I found with Threats anyway, and probably I will have to figure out a new trick for the next book, but was to write very short chapters. Chapter one is two paragraphs, and maybe I don't know, that looks like 450 words. And then each chapter is very short, and the goal that I had in writing it was that they would stand alone as short stories to begin with. And then eventually they start leaning on each other a little bit more. But my idea at first was that you could read a chapter and then go away from the book for a couple of days or a week and then come back and then read another one and feel that same kind of sense.
Yeah. Is it the case that most places where people go to learn writing, that the thing that you really work with people on is the story as form? It doesn't seem to me that if people just decide I'm going to be a writer, they may just sit down and write a novel. But if they do it in a more deliberate way, that the way that you teach people seems to be with the story.
Yes. Yeah. I got my MFA from Texas State, and it was very story oriented, although they were Tom Grimes is the head of that program, and he was interested as a novelist in teaching the novel. He had a great class on the novel where we would read one every week and talk about it as an entire work, which was actually very helpful in writing a novel, as you would think. But yeah, the short story form is what's taught and what I really love. And my second book is a collection of short stories.
Do you think that's just because it's a more manageable kind of thing, and you really in the kind of time and space that you have to work with people, you really can't do novels, but something that's shorter, that's something you can get a handle on?
Right, it's kind of a microcosm of the novel in a lot of ways. Yeah, but not every way. There's a payoff in the novel. I used to be so pro short story, I thought that I would never write a novel, actually. And I tried, and it was bad, and I said, oh, well, then I work in miniature, sort of like people make miniatures, and nobody asks them, well, why don't you build a ship, like a full-size ship, if you're working on these tiny ones all day? And it's like, well, I just don't. But I thought it'd be fun to try, so I did.
In this part of Focus, we're talking with writer Amelia Gray. Her most recent book, her first published novel, is Threats. It's recently out. It's published by Farrah Straus & Giroux. She's here to give a reading as part of the Carr reading series. It's sponsored by the Creative Writing Program here at the U of I. We'll talk some more after a very short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with journalist Matt Apuzzo, part of the Associated Press's investigative team that just won a Pulitzer Prize for revealing the New York Police Department's clandestine spying program that monitored daily life in Muslim communities. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by Hendrick House, providing housing and food service to University of Illinois students for 64 years. Hendrick House works to ensure a quiet environment for study and relaxation. More information is available at 365-8000 or at hendrickhouse.com.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, and we have 10 different topics for you every week. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll be talking with a scientist named David Stork, who is going to be here on the campus to give a talk on this subject. When computers look at art, image analysis in humanistic studies of the visual arts. So we'll talk about that. What computers see when they look at art tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock show. Also tomorrow morning, then we'll talk about bicycling in Champaign-Urbana. A lot of people are turning to bikes because they're good for you. It's healthy and it's good for the environment. And we'll talk with Gary Seco, who is chair of Champaign County Bikes, Laurie Pearson, who's president of the Prairie Cycle Club, Carl Stewart, coordinator of the U of I Campus Bike Project, about biking and some of the things that also the governments of our cities here are doing to try to make Champaign and Urbana a little bit more bike-friendly. Friday, we'll do something that we do every month on the program, and that's talk about money management and personal finance. We'll do both hours, actually. So we'll have plenty of time for questions, and we'll have rounded up all three of the guys who have, over the years, have done this a lot with us, David Sinnoh, Kevin Waspy, John Masetich. They'll be here to answer whatever questions you have about financial planning. That's on Friday. We are here weekday mornings, as I say, from 10 to noon, 10 different topics. You can check the schedule or listen to past programs by going to our website, which is will.illinois.edu. You can also follow us on Twitter at Will Public Media and also find us on Facebook. And in this hour of the show, we're talking with writer Amelia Gray. She's the author of three books. These are both story collections, right? AM, PM, and Museum of the Weird?
Yes.
Okay. And her newest, her most recent published work is Threats. That is a novel, and it's published by Ferris, Strauss, and Giroux. She's visiting Champaign-Urbana, the campus of the University of Illinois, to take part in the Carr Reading Series. It's sponsored by the Creative Writing Program in the Department of English, and she'll be giving a reading this afternoon at 4:30. This is in the Illini Union Bookstore in the Author's Corner down on the campus, and anybody who is interested in stopping by and hearing from her and meeting her should certainly feel welcome. It's open to the public. And here this morning on the program, 333-9455, the telephone number if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. So you grew up in Tucson, and then you were living in Austin. So is there some kind of a Western sensibility, mm-hmm. do you think, in your work?
I wonder. Well, I was born and raised in Tucson. I lived in Charlotte, North Carolina for 7 years, actually, between 7 and 14. Came back to Tucson, went to Arizona State up in Tempe, then Austin. I do wonder. I sometimes get asked to write for Southwestern-related publications, which is odd to me. I don't know. I really like a lot of Southwestern writers. Ed Abbey was a big Tucson guy and is buried out in the desert somewhere out there. And I've felt a real fondness of that type of writer and that type of writing, but I haven't written about Arizona very much or about Tucson. I almost started to, I think, now that I'm speaking out loud. I was writing about immigration a little bit. That's a hard topic. So I think I need to get more research under my belt or maybe more years before I tackle that one.
Yeah. So, and you got your MFA at at Tempe?
At Texas State in San Marcos. Yeah. Okay. Used to be Southwest Texas.
So when at some point in your life can you point to a point where you said, here I can tell you where it was I decided I want to be a writer?
Well, I had a class in high school where a philosophy class where the teacher allowed us to either write an essay talking about the concept or a piece of fiction. And that's when I first realized that I very much would rather write fiction than essays. And then after that, I kind of drifted around. I wanted to be a studio musician for a while, play the violin. But I ended up not being as good at the violin as I was at writing. In college, I kind of drifted towards creative writing classes. I just found myself enjoying it more and more. And I went to get the MFA pretty young at 23, and it progressed through that. And I liked it. No matter what job I was doing, I've worked in a hardware store and a sporting goods store. I worked at Target, Banana Republic. I've done tech support, computer lab watching. And through it all, I was writing. And so it finally got into my thick skull that I should probably just try to be a writer.
Yeah. So you picked two things that's almost impossible to make a living at, music and writing.
Right, exactly. Yeah, very smart.
But you do make a living actually writing, not writing fiction, but as a writer.
Right. I do, as I was saying, search engine optimized marketing writing for the internet.
And you'll have to, again, explain what is that? I know that sounds really good.
Sure.
I like the sound of it.
It's less complicated than it seems. So they're very common search engine terms that you use when you're searching for, say, home improvement projects. So you would maybe type into Google slate roofing composite or slate roof do-it-yourself. And then an article would show up written by someone like me. Where there's an informative piece that's well researched and correct ultimately, but includes the very items that you search for, so it shows up in Google. So it's a way of getting to the top of Google, because you generally, when you search for something, you pick the first, you know, through 1 through 5 links, and so a good SEO content will be on those 1 through 5 links, and then you go to the website and you read about it, and then maybe you, I don't know, depending on what the site is selling, buy some of it.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Is there some art to that, to getting in the appropriate number of references to what it is so that it'll come up on the top of your search?
Right, and then more importantly, to make it seem like it's not doing that, to make it seem very natural. And then to write within a very strict word count between maybe, say, 350 and 400 words, and then to write at a certain grade level, at the 8th grade level, so that everyone can pretty much understand it. So it's a lot of constraints, and as a writer who's always, I've always liked constraints, and it's always appealed to me. I've had this job for 6 years.
So how did you get into doing this?
I started... The call went out on my grad school email list, and I picked up with that. I had also I've written some study guides for textbooks and essay question, like multiple choice questions for test prep, kind of random things like that have to be very specific within a grade level, such as like 3rd grade or 4th grade, and you actually plug it into a program that tells you what grade level that you're writing at, and then you have to adjust the word choice. It's very neat.
Yeah. So I had to do this other thing, the search optimization thing, mm-hmm. You know, what do you call it? How long did it take you to learn to do that, or how did you learn how to do that? Was there some sort of set of rules that you could just follow and say, okay, I need to do this and I need to do this?
Mm-hmm. There were a lot of rules, and I've had the same editors for a long time. I wonder if any of them are listening. They're in Reno. But
They could very well be.
Yeah. I think so. No, they've been very sweet about my fiction writing too, and excellent editors of marketing work. A very, you know, they guide me as to how to write a lead, something I'd never known because I've never been like a journalism major or anything. How to structure an article, or how to appeal to a certain audience. How to write in different points of view, writing for different audiences. They give me a lot to think about in writing as a craft from there.
Yeah. Yeah. So is there some way that writing shapes, informs, does something for your fiction?
I think so. I've always wanted to write in a way that that everyone could understand. So I guess you could unromantically look at that as a grade level kind of thing. So I write to be very clear. And that could be, I don't know if that's informed by the marketing writing or if that's why I'm such a good marketing writer because I already did that. But no, I think very much in terms of the size and shape of paragraphs because of that job, for better or for worse, I suppose.
So what, I'm sorry, we're jumping around here, but going back to, you told the story about how you were in the philosophy class and you mm-hmm. could write a story, you could write an essay, and you said, well, I don't really want to write the essay, I'd rather write the story.
Mm-hmm.
What exactly is the difference between those two things? What appeals to you about the story?
I don't know, actually. That's a good question, because I was also very recently tasked with writing a nonfiction piece about water in Los Angeles. And I found it to be a very nerve-wracking subject, a nerve-wracking assignment, because it felt writing about my life and what I actually think about in reality somehow was more airless to me than writing fiction, which is my life and what I think about in reality. But there's some kind of veil that I liked more. So I would write about existentialism as a story, and I'd have two characters, and they would be, you know, looking at a fish trying to swim upstream and never quite making it, or, you know, whatever silly metaphor I had as a 16-year-old. And that, for some reason, made me a lot less nervous than writing what I believe to be the true tenets of existentialism. I'm a very nervous person and an anxious person. So fiction has always been a real nice security blanket for me.
Mm-hmm. So is it that you maybe what you're interested in doing in writing is to, if you can, rather than trying to explain something to someone, that it's more of a, what you're trying to communicate it through feelings or emotions, or that is, rather than explaining to somebody what something feels like, trying to get them to actually feel, and I don't know if that makes any sense.
No, it does make sense to give someone the experience of feeling, yeah, say, what I have felt in the past. There is a lot of that. And in sort of explaining something through, say, the novel, I'm really working through it myself of what would it mean to lose a lifelong partner, which I haven't and terrified of. And so the process of writing it had became a meditation, I guess, on that, trying to discover it, trying to share the feeling, but also to experience it myself.
So I guess I like that notion that maybe for readers, what it's about is experiencing things that they might not otherwise experience. Mm-hmm. But it sounds like maybe partly for writers, it's the same thing. Mm-hmm. It's experiencing stuff that they might not otherwise experience, or am asking themselves this question: well, what would it be like if I was going through the stuff that the characters are going through?
I think so. Yeah, I think exactly. I've been reading on Q84, the big Murakami book. Over my tour, and feeling that with him. He writes about the experience of a couple of women and how they're looking at the world, and I can see Murakami really enjoying getting into these female characters. And stoic one is a assassin, and you can feel him having fun with it, and also kind of, you know, pushing it and figuring out what it would actually be like.
Hmm. Yeah. About 7-8 minutes left in this part of Focus with Amelia Gray. She's visiting the campus here. She'll be giving a reading this afternoon. We're talking some about her novel, Threats. That's published by Ferris Strauss Saint Giroux. And questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here, you know, it's just, I don't know. It's something that occurs to me now and again because I know some writers and have talked to them. And one of the things that I know is that they're voracious readers, mm-hmm, and that they read a lot of fiction. Mm-hmm. So they're reading the work of other writers. And one of the things that I find myself wondering from time to time is how it is you avoid, and not that you would do it consciously, but maybe unconsciously, mm-hmm, picking up something from somebody else,
yeah,
and then putting it in your story and in effect, plagiarizing, and not, as I say, it's not like you would do that on purpose, but
right.
I would think that it would be difficult to avoid that without knowing that you were doing
right.
it.
Right. Well, I've talked to different writers about that because I'm also very curious about that. There's a writer named, Annie Prue, who never reads fiction, only reads nonfiction, and is very purposeful about that. Or Borges never read novels, ever. Just didn't like to, wasn't interested. And as for myself, when I was writing Threats, I started reading a really great collection of short stories called Knock'em Stiff by Donald Ray Pollock, which are very voice-driven, hilarious, Ohio-style, like, backwoods fiction that just reads so funny and true. But as I was reading it, I realized that my writing was starting to have this kind of edge to it that I didn't intend, and I was feeling his influence coming in very strongly. And I had to put the book down, which was hard because it was so good. And I finally got to finish it later once I wasn't working on a project. But I think it depends. I went to Infinite Jest as I was finishing Threats, and I found it didn't, the voice didn't creep in at all. But I think the expansive concept of idea started creeping in, and that's what I wanted. So I kept up with that. And I read less when I'm working on a big project, and then I like to read more, and I like to read voice driven stuff when I'm kind of taking a break. Like now I'm getting to this Murakami book, which is one of my old favorite writers, and this book is incredible. So it's been fun to get to it. And then hopefully when I'm back home, I finish the book and then I can work again.
So it sounds like it may be, at least for some writers, it's a matter of if you pick up something, maybe from something that you've been reading, and it gets into your writing, that there may be some way in which you sort of feel, well, wait a minute, that's really not me.
Mm-hmm.
And that you then can put that aside and try at least and get back to, you know, whatever it is that really is you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel that. I feel pretty sensitive to that, partly because I'm a very plain-spoken sort of mimetic writer. And when I start trying to write poetry, that's a red flag to me. Like, nope, too pretty. Too writerly, I guess.
Well, that's, I guess I was going to ask you about whether you had any interest in writing poetry. Now, whether you're, and I'm not sure when you talk about writing poetry, that means you're not thinking of that the form,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
but something about, well, quote unquote, what is,
yeah,
what does that mean, poetry?
Yeah, the poetic form or poetic writing are very, I don't know, beautiful writing. I play with it. I'd like to try, you know. Yeah. I get very jealous of writers like Donald Ray Pollock who write this gorgeous stuff. But I think there is a gorgeousness to mimesis and to a very sort of outwardly simplistic but very crafted work, which is what I aim for. So that's my style of poetry, I guess.
That's what the question just prompted again. I'm thinking of the Threats and how first that was one of my reactions to the Threats. I thought, oh, this is like a poem, except it's when you say it, it's a threat. and that I also was thinking about how you talked about how what you really like are miniatures, like really tight, little, very carefully crafted. Every word in the place, no words wasted. And that's kind of what poetry really is.
Sure, yeah. I mean, maybe that's what good writing is in general. And it's what I aim for.
Well, writing is really hard work. I don't know that people who haven't tried to do it really appreciate it, just how much sweat goes into it.
And blood.
And that it's not something that just falls out of the sky and falls into your lap,
but it's
something that you really have to work at really hard.
Mm-hmm. And a lot, and to write a lot of failed books and failed stories and to allow that to just happen over and over and over again, yeah.
So when you work on a piece, say you're working on a story, how much rewriting do you do? Do you go work on it?
It depends. I will revise at the sentence level, and so even though I write technically one draft, I'll be going through it for a long time. Lately, I've been writing very slow, maybe in part because I'm on the road, but I'll write a sentence a day or maybe two, and that's a good day. And they're pretty good sentences because I think about them quite a bit. But no, it's never fast anymore. I think the last story I wrote in one draft and pretty much kept was the first story in Museum of the Weird, which is called Babies. And I said what I wanted to say, pretty much said it in the order I wanted to say it, and it was done. But not since then.
Are you thinking about, you said you had written some bad novels, and there's Threats, so this is your first published novel.
Yes.
Is this something, a form that you'd like to go back to?
It was so much fun to have a character that you got to stay with and keep and to not have to worry about an ending quite so soon. I would love to go back. Either in the form of a novel or the form of a feature length screenplay but I think it's the same sort of feel of a long project that you can sit with. It was really nice.
Yeah. So do you have some sort of sense where things come from? like you said you sort of had this vague notion of the threat, of one person sort of issuing this threat to another, and then that kind of grew into threats, which then grew into the novel. Mm. Do things just sort of strike you, images just sort of strike you, and then you start thinking, well, that's interesting. What is this about? And then go on thinking more about it?
Yeah. Sometimes that is what happens. Or a phrase. Or wouldn't it be funny if a man was married to a paring knife? And then, there's a story I wrote about that. This idea of someone leaving you and then you being alone. What if that came in the form of someone actually vanishing completely out of life and leaving their cell phone and keys? What would that be like? And so I guess my work always starts with a kind of a reasonable idea, and then it is extrapolated strangely after that.
Do you have many stories about relationships between people and inanimate objects?
Yes, weirdly enough, yeah. I have a lot of stories about hair, a lot of stories about people having... the guy was married to a bag of frozen tilapia. There is another story about a woman who was... that trichotillomania was eating her hair. This kind of... I would really like to write a story about... someone who's in love with a building, but I fear it's been done.
People must think that you're very strange based on your writing. And, you know, people make this mistake to think that the stories really are about the people who write them. And, of course, in many ways, well, they are about the people that write them. Mm-hmm. But that do you find that people, when they meet you, they have some odd expectations of who Amelia Gray is?
Sometimes people get very nervous about meeting me, which is, I guess... I don't get it though, because I think I'm an approachable and friendly person, but I do write some very dark stuff sometimes.
Mm-hmm. So where does that come from?
I don't know where that comes from. I don't know. I think it's the idea of when you read, you think about who wrote it a little bit, despite yourself. I mean, I do it too, thinking about Murakami as I have been lately. And it's sort of bad practice because you never know what the person's actually going to be like, but, yeah, I've definitely experienced some people getting the wrong idea about me as a human.
Well, we'll have to stop because mm-hmm. we're here come to the end of the time. But if people would like to get a better idea who Amelia Gray is, maybe, yeah. You can stop by the Illini Union Bookstore this afternoon at 4:30. She'll be giving a reading. She'll be there in the Author's Corner. This is part of the Carr Reading Series. It's sponsored by the English Department and the Creative Writing Program. And throughout the year when the students are here, they bring writers. And I've been happy and lucky enough to talk with a lot of them, and really pleased that she could be here. And if you'd like to read her novel, Threats, it is out now. It's in paper, and it's published by Farrah, Straus, and Giroux. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much.